And now, two pigeons bemoaning the fact you can stream DirecTV satellite-free.
Hey, Frank, a little birdie told me you don't need a satellite dish to get DirecTV.
What's the little birdie?
Was it Jimmy the Sparrow?
It's a figure of speech. Point is, you can stream DirecTV over the internet now.
Oh, sure. Next you're going to tell me those big birds are made of metal and filled with people, right?
You mean airplanes?
Stream DirecTV without a satellite dish. Visit DirecTV.com. High-speed internet service required. Terms and restrictions apply.
Welcome to the Keith Law Show, presented by Topps. Check out Topps Project 70, celebrating 70 years of Topps baseball cards. This is episode 69, nice, of the Keith Law Show, and I am extremely excited to be joined by one of my favorite novelists today, Jasper Ford, author of the Thursday Next series, the Last Dragon Slayer series, Shades of Grey, Nursery Crimes, Constant Rabbit, Early Riser. I think I got them all. Lots of great books. I've been talking about him for years. Hopefully you've checked out one or two of his books. If not, I'm sure you will want to after this conversation. It was great. I have written one thing for The Athletic, for subscribers to The Athletic, since the last time we spoke, a long scouting post summarizing a bunch of minor league games I'd been to recently, including some five former first-round picks I believe were covered in the post, Spencer Torkelson and Riley Green from the Tigers. No Dylan Dingler. He had the night off. I can't believe it. Cade Cavalli from the Nationals, Greg Jones from the Rays, Jordan Westberg from the Orioles, and several other prospects. I also ended up, I don't usually do a lot in the comments under these posts, but people asked some pretty good and I thought somewhat universal questions that I think I was able to help answer. And just judging by your responses in the comments, it seemed like you agreed. So thank you for that. Thank you for reading. Thank you for weighing in the comments and letting me know I was actually doing something useful for a change. I would also like to remind everyone to check out my book, The Inside Game, Bad Calls, Strange Moves, and What Baseball Behavior Teaches Us About Ourselves, out in paperback this past April. I will have another post up for subscribers to The Athletic probably at the end of this week, looking at which teams did the most to improve their farm systems so far this season, which would include both the trade deadline as well as the draft. You can feel reasonably confident that the Cubs will appear somewhere on that list. I really liked what they ended up doing at the trade deadline this year. And finally, I do have an email newsletter. It is irregular. I basically send one out when I've got something to say, which is sometimes, but not on any regular schedule. So you won't get too many emails from me. But if you're interested, you can go to tinyletter.com/KeithLaw. And for folks who sign up this week, I'm going to do a board game giveaway. I ended up with two review copies of the new game Juicy Fruits from Capstone Games, which I'll be reviewing later this week at Paste also. It is a really, really great family game. My daughter and I have played it several times. We love it. And since I got two copies, I asked Capstone if they would let me just give one away to one of my newsletter subscribers, and they said, sure, absolutely. So if you are interested, feel free to sign up for the newsletter. I will also send out an edition later this week so you can check it out and see if you want to actually stay a subscriber after I have finished this giveaway. My guest today is the great Jasper Ford, the author of 16 novels, including the Thursday Next series, the upcoming The Great Troll War, which is due out in Europe in September, and The Constant Rabbit, a standalone novel, which arrived here last winter. You can follow him on Twitter at Jasper Ford, F-F-O-R-D-E. He comes to us from Wales. Cymru am byth. Jasper, thank you for joining me.
My pleasure. Thank you.
So let's begin. As an Englishman in Wales, have you made any attempt to conquer the local language?
I'm actually married to a Welsh lady, and she is a Welsh speaker. So I kind of, and both my daughters, because because I live in Wales, we go to school in Wales, and Welsh is spoken as part of the curriculum. So so I do have Welsh speakers in the house. So I kind of should, you know, really should learn it, but I kind of have too much on my schedule at the moment. And you can be Welsh and live in Wales and not speak Welsh, really, you know, at a pinch. And I like to kind of hope that I eventually might be Welsh, but I kind of think I'm, you know, this is my adoptive nation. So no, I haven't conquered the language, sadly.
Oh, good. I won't ask you then to explain how the soft mutations work, because I have been trying to learn bits of it, and it is, that part has lost me.
Oh, it is immensely complex. I'm just getting my head round pronunciations, and I can generally figure out most pronunciations, but they're kind of tricky. But
Once you get that, the Klinetli.
Oh yeah, you did good actually. Klinetli.
Thank you.
You have that. Yes, there's a very sort of sound to it.
Yes, all my wife speaks it.
Weird and lovely, beautiful sounds. It's a fantastic language. It really is. Fantastic.
Yes, I do. I love listening to it, but spoken at any, even like 75% of native speed, I have no chance. I can do the Duolingo app and slow it down a little bit, and then I can follow. But I have a feeling at some point we will go to Gardith and visit relatives, and I will say, nope, sorry, I didn't catch any. Can we switch to English now?
Isn't that great that you have actually Welsh-speaking relatives? That's quite something, isn't it?
Yeah, well, my wife was born here, but speaks English. Her parents were both born in Wales, and her mother still speaks some of it. And then many cousins there, the younger cousins, as you said, they teach it in school now.
Yeah.
So, you know, that generation, then younger, they're all learning it. So it's great. So when we've done like family Zoom quizzes, some of them will slip in some Welsh here and there. And it's great because I get that moment where I'm like, I got that. I understood those three words there. And that's all. Yeah. Then the moment passes. So let's talk about some of your recent books. Obviously, I'm a huge fan. I loved The Constant Rabbit, and I've always found your work to be satirical in nature anyway, but often more towards the silly side. And I say that as a compliment, whereas The Constant Rabbit seemed more overtly angry at the targets of your satire, or at least maybe more pointed with the satirical elements, that the book itself was designed to satirize our current moment. Is that a fair interpretation of the, at least what you had in mind when you created the work?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, you know, all my light satire before this clearly isn't working. And, you know, so you have to ramp it up a little. But also, I think we find ourselves, speaking here, you know, for obviously my nation, my politics, is that a lot of it seems to be sort of pre-satirized at inception, that you can't satirize it. You know, we live in a post-satire world. And I call it The Constant Rabbit as an unsubtle book for unsubtle times. And I think nowadays that if you've got something to say, you can't really beat around the bush. Subtlety doesn't seem to function as it used to. You know, look at that, you know, strange little whimsical, you know, comment, you know, that alludes to something. I don't think that really kind of works. I think you've just got to go in there and say, this is what I think and this is what I feel, and you know, well, to hell with it. I referred to it as my Brexit anger book, actually. For many years. I'm not sure whether that is. There's a lot more in it than just issues about that, but I think Brexit, certainly over here in the UK, and for those of us who did not support it, which I didn't, it was sort of, for me, I definitely felt that there was revealed parts of the British/English, maybe English character that we've been trying to hide for a while, about isolationism and exceptionalism, and a kind of rewriting, if you like, a sort of looking at our past and saying, you know, well, I think actually, you know, all that kind of empire stuff, you know, why can't we sort of hark back to that a bit, you know, and go it alone and be this sort of, you know, this island anchored off the coast of Europe, having nothing to do with it and wanting to be our own selves and carving our own identity and all this complete utter nonsense. And I find that very worrying. And then when you start looking at that and questioning, you know, my upbringing, because I was born in 1961. So really it's, you know, I mean, that's what, you know, 15 years after the last war ended, and being brought up then in this post, it was very post-empire in that time, and about British exceptionalism and how, you know, basically, you know, we won the war, and being brought up on war movies and all that kind of stuff. And after a while, you start thinking, was this actually was this actually correct? Was this the correct way to educate anyone? And of course it isn't, because you can't just teach the good stuff. You've got to teach the stuff that's dodgy as hell as well. And we have the British, you know, we have a lot of dodgy as hell history, which you know, if you're going to move forward, you've got to look at it. You know, it's, you can't just go, oh, wasn't it wonderful? You know, White Cliffs of Dover and a Spitfire. Oh, fantastic. You know, that's the bit we're going to remember. You go, no, that's not what we should remember at all. So, it was, there was a lot of anger and a lot of stuff that had just been bubbling away for a very long time. And it just sort of came out and there it was.
Yes. Yeah. And I found that, you know, obviously UKIP is one of your targets, very, very transparently, but you can simply it corresponds here to the rise of Trump, what you just described about not wanting to teach the dodgy bits. We are having this absurd battle here over critical race theory in schools, which they're not teaching in American kindergartens. I don't understand why people are protesting something that isn't actually happening. But the idea that you do not want to, it's American exceptionalism. It's the same thing. This idea that, no, America's great. We are the manifest destiny. Take over the continent, take over the world. That is, why would you say America is anything but the greatest nation? That's what we need to be teaching our children. And that, I am of the opinion that you teach the whole history, the good and the bad. And as you said, what is true of England is true. We are your former colonists, and we've taken a lot of that. We've done a lot of the bad stuff too, which we learned from watching you, apparently. So I did want to ask, why rabbits specifically? And I do love what you did, because it also lent itself to quite a bit of fun wordplay. I think it was leprophobia. Xenophobia. I hope I said it right.
Yeah, leporophobia. That is actually a thing. There is actually it's kind of the dread fear of rabbits, but I didn't make that up. The leporophobia is actually a thing.
I credited you.
If you go, rabbits, you know, furry, long ears, I hate them. You're leporophobic. All phobias have a name with them attached to them. Someone somewhere obviously sort of sat down and sort of just made them all up one day, you know, and had some Latin and Greek to hand. I think rabbits were great in that they just sat so well as the demonized other, as a kind of proxy, really, to all the, you know, human groups that have been the targets of discrimination over the years. Because the rabbits, we have a very complicated relationship with not only rabbits, not only other animals, but also with other humans. And I think with rabbits, it's great because we have a sort of a rather worrying prior relationship with rabbits. And of course, when you're anthropomorphizing an animal, you bring, obviously you make them human, and that's amusing, but you also bring some of the attributes of the animal, you know, into that mix, which again works really well. And I mean, it's very interesting that you know, the strained relationship in the past that we've had with rabbits is there's pretty much no way in which we haven't murdered rabbits that we haven't also murdered humans, you know, which is kind of worrying. But also the language which is used with rabbits when we don't like them is like a pest, plague, a vermin. You know, and these words are used by humans against humans to, you know, just try and demonize, you know, the groups. But when we like rabbits, of course, we use different words. We use cute and cuddly and fluffy and furry. And indeed, if you like want to go out and murder rabbits, you know, to get rid of them because you're eating your crops, then no one will turn a hair, and you can quite often, you know, be applauded for it, for doing so. But if you try and kill a pet rabbit, you could probably find yourself in court. And that's just so unbelievably bizarre, even in its own case. But I think, you know, Choice of Rabbits worked really, really well just because of that strained relationship. And also the tropes about that is often used, you know, by an oppressor against a discriminated group can so easily just flop into rabbits, which is like, you know, well, they breed. You know, and mm-hmm. you let one in and all of a sudden they're going to start breeding, and then, you know, they're going to take over. And before you know it, you know, we'll be doing what they do, which is having, you know, a sort of aggressive vegan agenda. And the rabbits in my book have their own religion which is, you know, seems quite fair actually. And then we'll all be, you know, worshipping with, you know, Lego, the rabbit god, and then it's the end of, you know, the end of Britain as we know it. So all that kind of stuff just really sort of clues in to the scare stories and the tactics, the scare tactics used by people with a very, very clear discriminatory agenda. So rabbits just work. I mean, they work so well. They really do. There's a rather lovely little sequence where give people an idea of what happens in the book. Sorry, should we say? So the book basically begins. Really, what's happened in like 1965 is that 18 rabbits are spontaneously anthropomorphized overnight. They're 6 foot tall. They can read. They can write. They can drive cars. They have all sorts of, you know, interests that humans have. But they're also very large rabbits. And it's now 2022, and there's 1.2 million of them in the UK. Mm-hmm. And the ruling party, the United Kingdom. Anti-Rabbit Party, or UKARP as they're known, who've clearly got power on an anti-rabbit rhetoric ticket, have decided they want to rehome all these 1.2 million rabbits in for their own safety in a huge mega warren in Wales, you know, which is, you know, very good of them, you know, for their own safety. Yes. They have to be put in this fenced off enclosure. And that's kind of where the story sort of begins. And my character, Peter Knox, lives in a little village in the middle of Middle England, and everything's fine. He doesn't consider himself leporophobic in the least. He works for the Rabbit Compliance Task Force, but if he didn't do it, someone else would, and, you know, he gets a pension and all this kind of stuff. And then some rabbits move in next door, and, you know, and then the fur sort of starts to fly because he knows Mrs. Rabbit, Connie. And the villagers say, look, you know them, you knew her, you know, try and get them out, you know, here's some money, see if you can buy them out, and if you don't buy them out, I'm sure there are other ways we can get rid of them. So there's this quite nice sequence where Kent, who's, they have these odd names, Kent Rabbit, who is the son of Connie, he's describing how he has all these there are anti-burrowing laws which are meant obviously to apply to humans as well as rabbits, but clearly only apply to rabbits because rabbits are the only ones that burrow. There's just endless laws against things that rabbits do, you know, and everything. So I really like it. It works so well with rabbits, I must say.
Yes. Yeah, I thought so. I liked it. It really lent itself well to that. Satirical element that I was referring to.
Looking for an assist with your credit card but can't get a hold of anyone? Luckily, with 24/7 US-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, you heard that right. You can talk to a real human in customer service at any time. Sounds like a real game changer if you ask us. Make the right call and get the service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard. Looking for an assist with your credit card but can't get a hold of anyone? Luckily, with 24/7 US-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, you heard that right. You can talk to a real human in customer service anytime. Sounds like a real game changer if you ask us. Make the right call and get the service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard.
Another of your standalone novels, and I know you and I talked a little bit previously about some of your novels. You start them as standalone, they become series. But Early Riser strikes me also as one. It's very extremely self-contained. Mm. I don't know if you intended to revisit that world. But one thing I found that really stood out about that one, to set for listeners who don't know, it's set in an alternate timeline where humans hibernate and sleep is thus valued very differently, very highly. But I noticed also that the text there, your descriptions of the world were substantially darker, and it gave the whole novel, it's still funny, all your work. I feel like you're the type of writer who probably couldn't not be funny, couldn't not inject humor. Now talking to you for a few minutes, I can see why.
Yeah.
But I mean, again, was that sort of, were you trying to set a different tone? I mean, this is just sort of my textual interpretation here, but that the color seemed more muted. A lot of the novel takes place at night. Also, it's set in Wales, so it's gray a lot of the time. Mm-hmm. That may just be appropriate to the setting, but it seemed like you were trying to say, no, this is a little different from the rest of my worlds. The rest of my worlds are sort of madcap and silly. This one is not grim, but just darker.
Mm. Yeah, this is, Early Riser. This is the sort of strapline or narrative dare I gave for myself with this was writer thriller set in a world in which humans have always hibernated. And when I have little ideas like that and I go, okay, I don't think this has been done before, and humans hibernating. Mm-hmm. And the fun bit with this is we've always hibernated. So we're different, you know, very subtly, physiologically, emotionally, socially, economically. Everything that's gone in the past is kind of the same. You know, Shakespeare was still around, but he would have written his plays based around people hibernating, because he would have hibernated mm-hmm. like anyone else. So that's the kind of the basic idea of it. And it takes place during the winter. Winters are very cold, very unpleasant. And I think it was me trying to write a story about humans as a species in trauma. And I kind of think we are a little bit in trauma at the moment. And there's a sense of pulling up the drawbridge with humans, because we have these existential threats. And really only yesterday, the new UN climate emergency document was published, which is, you know, makes for some pretty frightening reading, I must say. But it's nothing that we don't know and nothing that we haven't learned for 40 years. But it's taken this long for it to reach the table of politicians, which is, you know, extremely worrying. So Early Riser it was really the sort of subtleness about it. It's a thriller first and foremost. I like the characters in it. I like the situations. I think it's kind of fun, but it has been labeled as cli-fi, which is climate fiction, because what I was writing was essentially humans on the way to extinction. That this is not global heating. This is global cooling on a massive scale, and that's the reason that we have hibernation, and a lot of the action and a lot of what people are thinking about constantly is about trying to make up the loss rates of death during the winter, and that seems to dominate a lot of society's time and thought. But I think, just as you know, a lot of people here now, you know, we have a climate emergency at the moment. A lot of people aren't doing much about it. A lot of people are kind of pretending it doesn't exist. And that's the same in Early Riser, is this is a climate emergency. Humans are facing extinction, but sort of life carries on and we try to do the best that we can as we are. And I think because you're writing something that is about slightly oppressive and the weather is cold and it's dark, then that must come into it in ways that in my other book, I haven't really used the weather or the atmosphere in such a strong way. And I think it just adds to the sort of oppressive sense within the book, which I kind of liked. But it was a standalone, and I have no plans to write a sequel, I must say. But I kind of eventually kind of liked it. I didn't like it for a long time, that book. It was a really hard book to write. It took me about 3 years. Mm-hmm. Usually I can knock a book out in about a year. I mean, the rabbit book took me about a year and a bit. But this one was the hard book to write. But, you know, eventually it sort of came out. So I don't have a great relationship with it. I don't really want to revisit it, honestly.
Have you read much other cli-fi, by the way? I've only read maybe two or three books in that genre, no. Mostly because it's the world is depressing enough in that particular regard, so I don't need to visit it.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, I think that's the thing about entertainment, which is what my books essentially are, first and foremost, mm-hmm. is escapism. You know, we want to get away from the, you know, problems about, you know, paying the mortgage and, you know, worrying about the kids and, you know, the climate and everything else. So, I mean, that's why it wasn't overtly part of, you know, part of the story. I wasn't making a huge point. It was just there. But no, I haven't read any cli-fi, I must say. I think, I don't know.
I like that. That's a very Graham Greene way to describe it. He always said most of his books were entertainments. Mm. Then he had the serious, you know, The Power and the Glory and The Heart of the Matter. And I'm sort of I've read them all. Mm. I like the entertainments better, actually. Yeah, yeah. And probably me,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah, Troubles with My Aunt, you know.
Yes, real good, right? Yes.
Rollicking stuff.
Yes, yeah. Yes. Turns out he had a real knack for that, and some of the spy stories and the more serious stuff was like, okay, I mean, I recognize that that's good literature, but I'll go back to The Confidential Agent or Our Man in Havana was always my favorite because it's absurd.
Yeah.
It's beautifully absurd. Yeah. Yes. So good that John le Carré basically rewrote the book and called it The Tailor of Panama. Mm. It was almost exactly the same thing.
Yeah, sort of homage, we call it. Yes. In the writing profession, sure. A homage. We don't call it stealing outright. We call it homage.
Just borrowed. It's okay. Yes.
Yeah.
Yes. So we've also waited a few years for the final adventures of Jennifer Strange, sort of the last Dragon Slayer trilogy, which for folks who don't know is Jasper's series for young adults, which I started reading to my daughter when she was probably about 7 or 8. Now she's old enough she can read the fourth book by herself. I'm assuming she would no longer. She's 15. I don't think she would actually want me to read the book to her. Who knows? Teenagers are unpredictable. But I know originally the plan was for a trilogy, and you get to the end of the third book. I won't spoil anything. But something happens that opens it up. It's like, oh no, wait, we're on another cliffhanger here. So was that, you know, at what point, I guess, obviously it wasn't the plan at all. So at what point did it just sort of organically happen, or did you come at some point and say, no, I've got more, I want to extend the series by another book?
Yeah, I mean, I tend to write with absolutely no plan at all. I just have my idea, my like narrative dare, you know, like the one about the rabbits or Early Riser. And then I just start writing and just write whatever I sort of, whatever works, you know. I'd have no plan when I'm starting. And I think with Last Dragon Slayer is the original book was a standalone, and there was no sequel, no nothing. But when the publishers very generously wanted to publish it, they said, can you do a sequel? And, you know, I'm not going to say no, you know, I do not wish to for you to publish my book. You know, I do not wish to accept your money. You know, of course you say yes, you know, of course I can. And then you start thinking, well, you know, what am I going to do? So I just started writing sequels, basically. And I wrote one, which was, you know, just carried on pretty much where we were. And then I did another one, which was more of a sort of quest kind of feel to it. And the big problem about writing books is, you know, one of the hardest things, you know, it's sometimes you can dialogue, you know, you can do and you go, oh, that works. And you can do a sentence and you go, well, that sentence works. And that paragraph is quite good. You know, and that chapter is all right. You know, and that chapter ending is good. But finishing a book, and I mean finishing, not just abandoning, you know, although, you know, everybody says no book is ever finished, it's only ever abandoned, which I think is kind of true. But finishing a book in a way that is just wraps up everything nice and neatly, and for the reader is a really nice ending where you kind of deliver the goods. You've been setting your reader up for 100,000 words, and now bang, boom, there you are, the book's finished, and it's satisfying, and you can walk away and you can close the book and you can walk away and go, okay, I enjoyed that was good, and it delivered. I hate books that don't deliver at the end in the way I hate movies that don't deliver at the end. And I think this is kind of very human, you know, because we don't know how our story ends up. I mean, I put that in a book years ago, where someone who's quite elderly says, you know what the worst thing about dying? And they go, what? And they go, you never get to see how it all turns out. And and that's true, because you know, we love narratives, you know, humans love stories, we learn by them, we're entertained by them, and we converse with them all the time. And we do love a good ending, we do love a satisfying ending. But for all of us, of course, you know, the ultimate big story of how this all pans out, you know, what do? We get to the stars? I don't know, I'd love to know, but I'm not going to find out, and that's really annoying. So I think satisfying ends to books, you know, really fulfill something in humans that they really, really want to get. It's just some sort of closure to a story and to the characters that just finish everything nicely. But finishing a book is hard. You know, it's very hard to do satisfying. And I think out of my 16 books, I've maybe done it maybe 4 times, perhaps. It's very difficult. But then when you do actually have a satisfying ending, you go, I really like that. It's a really good feeling for a writer. But also, and this is something I've never done before, is that I'm actually finishing a series, because I have like three open series, and I'm closing one, the first time I've ever done it. And I'm actually having a season finale, Now, we've all had season finales on TV, which just do not work. And you can see they just want the third season. So they kind of give you a bit of a cliffhanger. and it ends and like there's nothing happened. You know, what happened at the end of My Name is Earl? And you go, no, nothing. We have no idea. You know, it just closed. And, you know, I want to know what happened to them, but we never will. So finishing the book was actually very satisfying for me because I liked the ending. But also it managed to make me end the series in a way that's quite satisfying, because I had no idea where the series was going to go, and I think that's why it went to the fourth book in the end. So I had to reread everything and then figure out, okay, how can I construct an ending which takes all this stuff that's already happened, which I had no clue about, because I never write to a plan. So it was really just taking out the elements that I thought might work and just trying with this sort of narrative gymnastics to bring it all together, add a few bits of fun and everything like that, and then just close it off nicely. But it was quite interesting because also throughout the whole series, you have these secondary characters who have helped Jennifer, your protagonist, down the line. And you don't want to kind of abandon them in book three if there's a book four. So quite often they had little walk-ons in which they could come along, do their thing, help the narrative along, help Jennifer along, and then just bow out very quietly and gently. And that's, you know, that's it for you. You know, that's your end as a character. So I was quite pleased to do that. And the people I really enjoyed in the series, I could actually bring back. So it was quite an interesting little experiment. Oh, and I got to appear myself as well in it. So that was quite amusing as well. Yeah, so I've always wanted to kind of...
A little Quentin Tarantino
type. Yeah, maybe, sort of like yourself. That. But I actually play myself. You know, he doesn't ever come on as the film director, does he?
No, someone else. He tries to act.
Yeah, he does. It doesn't always go that well. It used to work, but it doesn't seem to work anymore. So I don't know what's gone wrong there. But anyway, so I had this idea that I could actually insert myself into the book, because at some point they're told that the evil person's plan is more wild than they can possibly imagine. And this is a bit of a problem for them, because if his plan is wilder than they can possibly imagine, then they can never figure it out. Right? They'll never be able to figure it out because they can't imagine it. So Someone says, look, why don't we get a fancy author in, because they can have all kinds of weird ideas, you know, and they go, well, I know of one. And then there I am, you know, in the book, and they start quizzing me about my novels, you know, so what have you written? You know, I've not heard of you, you know, what have you written? I'm going to explain, you know, and I go, well, sort of nursery rhyme is police procedurals. And they go, well, yeah, I think that's been done before. Anything else? You know, and they give me a bit of a grilling. They don't treat me well at all. You know, it's like, yeah, who are you? What was your name again? Which I kind of like, but at least I get to do a little bit, you know, so I turn up.
And now, two pigeons bemoaning the fact you can stream DirecTV satellite-free.
You see this? A family watching baseball on DirecTV with no satellite dish in sight.
Let's heckle them.
You call that changing the channel?
Choke up on the remote, buddy.
I hope getting all these games on DirecTV makes up for your mother not pre-chewing your sunflower seeds.
DirecTV has the most MLB games. Visit DirecTV.com. Claim based on total games offered on national and regional sports networks with choice package or higher. Availability of RSNs varies by zip code and package. High-speed internet service required. Terms and restrictions apply.
And now, two pigeons bemoaning the fact you can stream DirecTV satellite-free.
You see this?
A family watching baseball on DirecTV with no satellite dish in sight.
Let's heckle them.
You call that changing the channel?
Choke up on the remote, buddy.
I hope getting all these games on DirecTV makes up for your mother not pre-chewing your sunflower seeds.
DirecTV has the most MLB games. Visit DirecTV.com. Claim based on total games offered on national and regional sports networks with choice package or higher. Availability of RSNs varies by zip code and package. High-speed internet service required. Terms and restrictions. Apply.
So, well, that's actually a perfect segue to my last question. Readers of mine know I've talked for years about this class I took in college, which is 27 years ago. Yes, something like that. Anyway, called Comedy in the Novel. And one of the books, it was actually the book that was cut from the curriculum, but he mentioned it. Actually, afterwards, I reached out to the professor and said, anything else you would have included? At Swim Two Birds by Flann O'Brien, where the author actually appears as part of the text, one of the sort of great early works, I would say, of metafiction. It's the class that introduced me to The Master and Margarita and If on a Winter's Night, a Traveler. It also made me read Don Quixote, which I doubt I ever would have done on my own just because it is a lot of, right, what is about 1,000 pages, the whole thing together. But I actually read it and liked it, as it turns out. So, and I posed to listeners, no, I'm not springing this on Jasper. I asked beforehand, but if you were going to teach a class like this, set up a curriculum of some great comic novels that you've enjoyed, what sort of books would you include?
Mm. Yeah, it's a good question, actually. And it would be tempting to do the obvious, like Three Men in a Boat, Jerome K. Jerome, which is, you know, yeah. an early adopter of mine. I remember mm-hmm. reading that when I was very young, and that stuck with mm-hmm. me. And I still laugh out loud reading. There's a sequence where he has to get a cheese on the train from like Liverpool down to Brighton.
Yes.
And it's, you know, the adventures of this cheese, and it's hysterically funny. It's laugh out loud funny. And books are difficult to do laugh out loud. You know, there's another section that Bill Bryson in The Adventures of the Thunderbolt Kid, he has this sequence where his best mate's dad is about to jump off the top board in this lake where they go swimming. And it's, you know, it's about 700 or 800 words, and it is unbelievably funny. but I think before I do, I think there's this interesting thing about comedy is that when you're writing comedy, you have this wonderful luxury of a huge build-up. You know, writing, you know, laugh out loud stuff is great. But you can also do comedy in two ways. There's a long build-up. It's like, you know, the recurring jokes and returning to jokes and stuff like that, which mm-hmm. which works really, really well. And you can have a long build-up to a really good payoff, you know, and that kind of joke will stay with you forever, with a reader will stay forever. But if you go to, say, stand-up comedy, you know, and you listen to a stand-up comedian, you can be laughing for an hour and a half, and 2 days later, you can't remember a single joke. So it's this sort of this low, slow, you know, glow, slow burn of really, you know, mm-hmm. great memorable comedy, or there's this like, you know, just sort of, you know, sharp forest fires of stand-up. So, and I think that's what you can do in books. And I think, you know, someone like Bill Bryson, who I mentioned before, I love mm-hmm. his writing because there is some of it is laugh out loud funny, but there is also a charm and a sparkle that runs throughout his books that explains things in a very lovely, sort of very beautiful, very understanding way that it has a wry sense of humor to it, which I really, really enjoy. He wrote a book about a summer in 1927, and you would have thought, you know, that would be kind of dull, you know, but it's not. Mm-hmm. It's lovely, and he makes it really, really good. Catch 22, another good one for comedy. Yes. They're really obvious ones. Diary of a Nobody by Burton Whedon Grossmith, the protagonist of which is a nobody, literally a nobody, and it's his failed attempts at social climbing in Victorian London in sort of, you know, the 1880s. It's very amusing thing. But anyway, so what?
And very short too.
It's short, yeah. It's short. It's a really good one for, you know, a short train journey. You know, they're actually really good. But I mean, too, I'd like to sort of mention that. Mm-hmm. that are sort of not on people's radar, which I thought were excellent. I really, really like them for the comedy. The first one would be John Birmingham, who is an Australian writer. I've actually met him. He's actually a really nice guy. and he wrote a book called He Died with a Falafel in His Hand, which is a great title. And
yes, it is.
Yeah, it's a great title. And
you had me at falafel.
It's basically a character study of humans and told through house share. So he's the protagonist is essentially running a house share, and it's all the people who come in and all the different characteristics of these sort of people and what they get up to and what they do. And it's just this wonderful sort of smorgasbord of strange, weird, unusual characters, all of whom you recognize as someone that you probably know. And I really, really enjoyed it. And it's a great comedy novel. The other one I'd like to recommend, again, as a really nice sort of character study, is by a British author called Mill Millington. And the book is called, and I might have got it slightly wrong, but I think it's called Arguments That I've Had With My Girlfriend, which again is a really good title.
Yes, it is.
Yeah, and it's about him and his girlfriend, now wife, called Margaret, who is German, and she comes across as a very sort of forthright and what perhaps we British would describe as someone typically German, but I don't think there is typical German. but it's about their relationship together. And it's seemingly an impossible relationship because they just cannot get along. But you know they do, and that fundamentally right. they love each other very, very much. And it's just, I don't know, it just has a charm and a sparkle and a beauty to it that's about humans getting along, about nations getting along, and about this, you know, rather sort of strange and slightly argumentative girlfriend that he has. But it also has the, and something that I've used a number of times, I think, and which is a trope that you see quite used more and more, of the slightly rubbish bloke, a protagonist who's not heroic and is not really anti-heroic. They're just a little bit rubbish, and I think they're much more of an everyman. You know, it's the antithesis of sort of Jack Reacher. This would be someone who'd you know, drive into a strange town in a taxi and leave the following morning and nothing would happen. It's that kind of person. and I kind of like that, you know, because it's not machismo. It's not about, you know, that all those classic sort of slightly dull male, you know, attributes. It's about someone who's just a bit rubbish, but has very strange characters moving past and through them and how they deal with it. So yeah, Mill Millington, arguments I've had with my girlfriend. I loved it. You know, really nice, really nice book.
Perfect.
Yeah.
Oh, I will absolutely read both of those. I've read the other ones. I have not read the Bill Bryson book. I will check that
out. Yeah, that's well worth it. Yeah.
Yeah.
Summer of
1927. I've read some of his nonfiction.
Yeah, Summer of 1927, nonfiction. It's a tremendous read. I wanted him to do the Summer of 1928, you know, as a sequel, but maybe it wasn't so interesting. but great stuff. You just read it and you go, wow, I did not know that. I did not know that. That is so bizarre.
If I enjoy a writer's prose, it doesn't entirely matter what the subject matter is. I mean, I'm sure there's a limit to that, of course. But if I, you know, there's certain writers where it's just whatever they put out, I'll just read it. And I might like one more or less, but it's not. So it is, especially for nonfiction, if it's just a well-told tale, it doesn't actually matter if a whole lot happens. I just find I can get sucked into someone's writing and be very happy, and especially, you know, put me in a small metal tube flying in the sky. If the book is good, I'll just not notice the time passing. Some people just sort of have that knack. Yeah. When you and I were talking previously, I mentioned Connie Willis, who wrote To Say Nothing of the Dog, her sort of time travel companion to Three Men in a Boat. She's one of those. I've read six or seven of her books. And for a long time, I thought she was English because she's such a good writer. Turns out she's from Colorado.
You see. Yeah. We're writer's always pulling a fast one, aren't we?
Yes. Well, and her time travelers are all set at Oxford. So it is like this is historians at Oxford. That's the only time travel is very tightly managed in this universe, and they have to get special permission to do it. And they can't go back. And obviously they can't change historical events. Anyway, one of her characters in this book goes back and finds the three men in the boat. And hilarity ensues, obviously. And is very much, it has the same book was only written 20 years ago, but it has the feel of a comedy of manners of 50, 60, 70 years earlier. So it's, you know, she's just one of those writers where it doesn't matter that not a lot happens. I get sucked in to the prose and her characters are interesting enough and I'm good to go.
Yeah. I mean, going back to Three Men in a Boat slightly, I mean, it works actually really well because it's, if you read it at one level, you could, because every now and again, he just reports on what's on the Thames. So you think, okay, I think this is like a sort of 1400 word guide to traveling down the Thames, and which he's just got bored and sort of thrown in these little anecdotes along the way about, you know, people, you know, with boasting about fishes and trying to get into a tin of meat, and they beat it into such an unpleasant shape so that it frightens them, you know, which I love. And they're all a bit useless. I mean, they really are a bit useless.
Oh, yes.
And I think that's, you know, a lot of it is that charm. And I think there's a really good, so almost a vaudeville kind of comedy to it as well, where you're trying to tell a serious story, but all the anecdotes that you keep on bringing in actually, you know, make it all that more funny. So I think, you know, there is that charm in it as well.
Yeah. And it's in the public domain for folks who haven't read it. You can usually find it free or for a dollar on Kindle. Yeah. That's how I read it, free a while ago.
Totally free. Yeah, 1881 it was written, and it's and it could have been written last week, and right. All the characters in it are so, we haven't changed. You just do not change.
Where, as it turns out, we are all still quite useless.
Yeah, that's. I mean, it's like Don Quixote, you know, like you were mentioning earlier. You know, I think I know someone that tilting at windmills. I mean, it's still happening.
Yeah,
still happening.
Yes, it could very well be me, and I just wouldn't even know it. Like, as he did not, right? No, those are giants. What are you talking about?
Yeah, exactly. And then you were talking about Graham Greene. He did Monsignor Quixote, didn't he?
One of his later novels.
Yeah.
He still had it right up until the last.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. My guest today has been the wonderful Jasper Ford. I have to confess I am a longtime fan. It's been a great honor for me. You should check out any of his books, but I will specifically mention the most recent one published here in North America was The Constant Rabbit, which, although it satirizes what's going on in the UK and Brexit, you can certainly see a lot of the parallels to what's going on in the United States, or has been going on here for the last few years. And you can also follow him on Twitter at Jasper, F-F-O-R-D-E. Jasper. Dioch, thank you for joining me.
No, my pleasure. It's been a lot of fun. Thank you very much.
That's all for this week's show. Thank you so much for listening. If you haven't been vaccinated yet, please go do so. If you're hesitating, there's lots of ways to reach me. I would be happy to try to address some of your concerns. You can find me on Twitter at Keith Law, on Facebook at Keith Law Writer, on Instagram at Mr. Keith Law. And I have been answering vaccine hesitant people's questions for a long time and combating anti-vaxxers misinformation for a long time. If you're interested, if maybe I could help push you towards getting vaccinated, I am happy to spend the time to do so. Thank you everyone for listening, and stay safe.
As you've probably heard by now, we've teamed up with BetMGM this season. We'll be using BetMGM lines to make all of our picks, and we'll have special offers for our listeners each week. If you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC, and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager with BetMGM. Here's how it works. Download the BetMGM app and sign up using bonus code THEATHLETIC. Make your first deposit of at least $10. Place your first bet on any game and claim your voucher for a one-year subscription to The Athletic. See BetMGM.com for terms. U.S. promotional offers not available in D.C., Mississippi, New York, Nevada, Ontario, or Puerto Rico. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. Available in the U.S. Call 877-8-HOPE-NY or text HOPE-NY 467-369 in New York. Call 1-800-NEXT-STEP in Arizona. 1-800-327-5050 in Massachusetts. 1-800-BETS-OFF in Iowa. 1-800-270-7117 for confidential help in Michigan. 1-800-981-0023 in Puerto Rico. First bet offer for new customers only in partnership with Kansas Crossing Casino and Hotel. Don't forget, if you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager.